Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The band Gang of Four formed in the British city of Leeds in the late 70s. There were contemporaries of other post-punk bands from that era, like Joy Division, Wire, and The Fall. Maybe you've heard of Gang of Four, maybe you haven't. Either way, it won't surprise you when I say that Gang of Four influenced a lot of rock bands. That just kind of goes with the territory of being a successful post-punk band, which Gang of Four is. They were abrasive, danceable, and unapologetically political. What's unique about Gang of Four, though, is the sheer breadth of their influence. You'll hear that influence in indie bands like Liars and Bloc Party, but also in the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Nirvana and R.E.M. And you'll hear Gang of Four songs sampled in the music of Moby or Frank Ocean or even on the new Run the Jewels. Gang of Four carried on in a handful of iterations, but the core of the band remained more or less the same. Guitarist Andy Gill and vocalist John King. Gang of Four never really disbanded until last year, when Gill died suddenly at 64 of pneumonia and organ failure. His widow suggested he may have been an early victim of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, the indie label Matador Records is reissuing the work of Gang of Four. Gang of Four 77 through 81 is a four-record box set that revisits and elevates some of the band's most important releases, including their debut, Entertainment. Ahead of release, my friend Jordan Morris sat down with the singer John King to talk about the band, its legacy, and what it was like playing danceable music at punk rock shows. Here's another Gang of Four classic, Damaged Goods.
John King, welcome to Bullseye.
Hi.
So Gang of Four gets categorized as a punk band or a post-punk band, but there's so much going on in the music. It is such a rich, hearty soup. There is, you know, R&B, there is funk, there is dance music, there's disco. I want to hear about the music you were listening to around the time the band got started.
Andy and I had quite similar tastes. We'd known each other since we were young teenagers, and at the beginning we deified Jimi Hendrix. So Jimi Hendrix was an enduring love. I mean, even now I play Voodoo Child, Slight Return, probably every week, as I played my entire life. So Electric Ladyland was kind of like the template for it. And actually when Jimi died, Andy wore a black armband to school, because we went to the same school together. So there was Hendrix to start off with. And the other outfit that I absolutely adored was The Band and their songs of American Life and Bob Dylan, of course. But along with that was this really strong love of reggae and funk. And the sorts of everything by James Brown, Electric Blues, Muddy Waters. In fact, when we started off, we used to do a couple of Muddy Waters covers, and not very well, but that was something that was really inspirational. So African-American music was really, really important. And we loved dancing. So we always, and reggae in particular, I don't think it happened in the US in the way that it did in Britain. But one of the records that was played to death by both me and Andy and Hugo and Dave was the Trojan Story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which was sensational. And all those tracks by bands like Scatterlights and Dave and Ansel Collins. And so reggae music was really important and you know, it was inspirational. But, of course, when you're a bunch of white guys, you don't want to be in ripping off someone else's tradition, but you want to learn from it and be inspired by it. Like more or less every single British musician has ever since. They listen to blues records like Led Zeppelin did and make a record that's kind of developed from that. Or Hugo, his great love was Free. And we all shared a common love of the drumming of Simon Kirk. And of course, the spare guitar work, you know, that was there. So it was a sort of James Brown, funk, reggae, and the other band that I think more than any other band inspired us at the beginning was Dr. Feelgood. And Dr. Feelgood was this stripped down, dry bunch of drunks from Canvey Island. I mean, I'm being unkind, but you know, that Wilco Johnson was the model for Andy's guitar playing and for a while, and Lee Brillo, who was the singer, you know, was someone I admired hugely. So we liked all that stuff.
And I'm curious about the term post-punk, which a lot of people use when they talk about Gang of Four. Do you remember when you first heard that, and do you feel like it's a good way to describe the band?
I'm not. I think with all of these labels, there's a conundrum. You know, we all want to find some way of clumping stuff together, but they are always applied after the event. I mean, when I think it is true that you see sort of mental affinities between sort of a band like us and New Order and Public Image as operating in sometimes in the same sort of vocabulary, musical vocabulary. But I mean, when the music that actually inspired me and I needed to get going and form a band was the New York bands, which were certainly not post-punk bands, you know, because we went out in 76 and we were going to CBGBs every night. And it was bands like Richard Tell and the Voidoids, you know, and Television and early Talking Heads and the like. And so I don't know that it's necessary. I don't know how useful it is, but I can see why people do it, if that's a good answer or not.
No, it's a great answer. It's one of those things where it's like, it's not perfect, but you know, sometimes you need words like that to talk about music. So,
yeah. And we had formed very strong friendships with, Pylon and REM, who were our support bands for quite a while out of Athens in Georgia. And you know, there's certain places you go to where you feel an affinity, you know, and felt an affinity to Athens at that time.
Yeah.
There seemed, and the B-52s were from there. You had an idea that there was a creative energy. One of my favorite, all time favorite bands was the Ramones. I loved the Ramones. I saw them loads of times. And I loved the Feelgoods. But what I didn't really like is chords. I didn't really like, actually, it was the Ramones, of course, sounded like the Beatles with, you know, that grungy stuff underneath it. And right. Years later, you know, you think of bands like Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, who sort of picked up on that vibe.
Sure.
But the Sex Pistols music was really exciting at the time, but it's really conservative. I mean, it's Black Sabbath with challenging lyrics, but
yeah,
Pretty Vacant is really a Sabbath song. Speed it up, and with those lyrics.
So when your band was starting out, England was going through some really tough economic times. Did that situation affect what you were doing in the band in any way?
It's not an original thought to say that the best art is made when things are really bad. There's a film called The Third Man, which is made in 1948, and it's Orson Welles, is one of his great movies. and he plays a someone who sells adulterated or fraudulent drugs, penicillin, to the people, and they're at the top of a reel, and they have this. He has a show face to face with the police officer or the military guy who's wants to arrest him or execute him, and he says, Italy through the Renaissance is war, famine, death, poisoning, betrayal. The result, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael. And then he says, Switzerland, 400 years of peace. What do you get? The cuckoo clock. And so I think we were lucky enough to live in the former. It wasn't lucky. I mean, Leeds was really, really bad. Britain was really bad. I at the beginning of the Boxer, I wrote a little kind of introductory one-page essay about if you went to the centre of London, Leicester Square, there was garbage piled, you know, 14, 15 feet high. The gravediggers had gone on strike. And so they had run out of places to store the corpses. So they were renting refrigerated trucks to store stacks of corpses. Animals were starving on the farms. There was one in four adult males was out of work. I mean, it was pretty intense. And I think because we wanted to write about the world that we lived in then, it didn't seem to me to be an interesting subject to write songs about girls and cars.
Yeah, it is interesting when, you know, you do hear the Gang of Four takes on the love song at that time. I'm thinking about Love Like Anthrax specifically.
Yeah.
And, you know, that being such an anti-dark love song. It is interesting how you guys were, you know, taking some of this familiar stuff and putting it through the lens of what you saw going on.
Yeah, I mean, again, something I put in the book was a great quote from Bertolt Brecht. He said, how can you write songs about trees when the woods are full of policemen? And it's, you know, those subjects were really real to us all. You know, sometimes like songs like Natural's not in it. You know, you're sitting there thinking, how did I end up like this? I feel actually, having done At Home as a Tourist, I remember about a year after that, Talking Heads came out with that one, you know, you may find yourself in a beautiful house, which is right. that subject, you know, that you suddenly get this moment of existential strangeness. You think, how on earth did I get here? You know, was it going through that door or another door? You know, how on earth did my life end up? It's this series of random events, and yet you are wherever you are. And it can be quite disconcerting. You wonder whether you're an actor in some cosmic play, in which you've actually just been reading your lines from the word go. And it's a sort of, it can be a disturbing moment for lots of people when they get that.
We'll finish up with John King of Gang of Four after a quick break. We'll talk about what it's like to hear your band sampled by Frank Ocean and Run the Jewels. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Hey, it's John Moe. And look, these are challenging times for our mental and emotional health. I get it. That's why I'm so excited for my new podcast, Depression Mode. We're tackling depression, anxiety, trauma, stress, the kinds of things that are just super common but don't get talked about nearly enough. Conversations that are illuminating, honest, and sometimes pretty funny, with folks like Patton Oswalt, Kelsey Darragh, and Open Mike Eagle.
I have this public-facing self, and then I have my emotional self that tends to stay hidden. It was about finding a way to communicate to somebody that, like, there's terrible shit going on back here.
Plus psychiatrists, psychologists, and all kinds of folks. On Depression Mode, we're working together, learning, helping each other out. We're a team. Join our team. Depression Mode for maximum fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, our guest is John King. He was the lead singer of the hugely influential post-punk band Gang of Four. He's being interviewed by Maximum Fun's Jordan Morris. The band just released a box set looking back at some of Gang of Four's earliest recordings, including their 1979 debut, Entertainment. Let's get back into it.
Something interesting about Gang of Four's music is that, you know, you have these danceable beats and you have these great melodies, but also just there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of noise and, you know, the rhythms kind of like break down and put themselves back together. And they, you know, they kind of hit you in a way that you don't expect. I want to talk about that dissonance that's in some of the songs and why you thought it was important to have that in the music.
Andy was a brilliant guitarist, and he was a brilliant non-technical guitarist. And so he had this fantastic ability to tease a sound out of some steel strings. And just like, you know, if you ever listen, everyone's listened to it, but you listen to, you know, the document of rock and roll, is, you know, Robert Johnson's recordings of the late 1920s, you can hear the strings. You can hear the scraping, you can almost hear the touch of his fingers on the stuff. You've got a physicality about it. And some of those noises are so gorgeous, you know, like on the Great Velvet Underground tracks, you know, on VU or Velvet Underground meets Nico, trying to find noises that sound like the end of the world. And to do that was, you know, Andy's genius on the guitar was to pull out those noises, which start off somewhere between Jimi Hendrix and Wilco Johnson and end up this other place, but to make things that have got that dissonance. And again, think of band things. Sometimes we say we want a song without any key changes. There are no chord progressions in quite a lot of the songs. And so what you needed was this incredibly propulsive and powerful rhythm section. So Dave and Hugo would come up. I think a good example of that is What We All Want. Dave was, he'd learned to play the bass by listening to the Meters, you know, one of the world's greatest ever bands, you know. I think when I first, not the first time met him, but pretty soon, I remember he and I getting so excited about listening to Sissy Strut over and over again by the Meters. And he, that's how he'd learned it, from listening to Sissy Strut and reggae. And but there was also this sound of Can, you know, the German noise band. So, that used to be that in that kind of kraut rock thing, of that sort of propulsive driving on thing. And so he played this funky stuff because he used to be, in a covers band, you know, where it was played, you know, R&B and country and western and stuff. And it was applying what Dave and Hugo were able, brilliant at, applying the aesthetic of funk, where you get a groove and you lay it down and you've got to stick with it. You've got to be on the one. And then you're with the one, and then when you go away from the one, it's a thrill. And you know, like James, the master himself, James Brown. But where James Brown was all about the one, we started being about where you went when the one was there. And so Andy would then improvise like mad over this screwed down bam boom bam 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 would be popping along. And then Andy would like be careening around the place, knowing that you could always come back to the one. And that's when dissonance works. Because if it's just if everything's dissonant, it doesn't work. Which I used to listen to quite a lot of jazz music, and I could never really get on with free jazz too much because it was actually too much being dissonant against each other. A failing of mine, not of the art form. But so the dissonance is really thrilling. It's thrilling if you got a one, or it's thrilling if you got a four, even. But it's not thrilling if it's all a mess, you know.
I heard the Gang of Four was invited to play on Top of the Pops, which at the time was a, you know, huge TV show that really drove record sales. And I think the story goes that you guys walked off. I would love to hear that story and, you know, if there were repercussions down the line.
Top of the Pops was certainly in Europe the most influential TV show there's ever been. I mean, if you got onto that show, you were going to have a top 10 single. And they had very strange rules that you got on. This was to avoid payola and bribery and corruption. You got on the show if you had a single that had gone into the top 30, and you therefore you had to be offered a slot. If you're going down the charts, you weren't on the show. The only person that could stay on the show if they were in the same position was number one. Everyone else, if you were stayed in the same position or you went down, you weren't on the show. So we had released the incredible pop classic of Home Is a Tourist, we're talking about dissonance, to the amazement of EMI. It had got into the top 30. This record that sounds like someone's at a train derailing in Grand Central Station. It's a wonderful guitar row at the beginning, which is fantastic. And following those rules of the screwed down rhythm section and the guitar going off on its holidays. And the program used to go out at like, I think it was 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night. Basically anything goes after 9 o'clock. That's when you hear the C word and the F word and all that kind of stuff. There are no limits really to what happens there anymore on TV. But up until that point, it's the watershed. Up to that point, you've got to be kind of delicate and you can't use profane language and stuff. And the lyric on the chorus was, "The rubbers you hide in your top left pocket," because it's not a very challenging idea that people go to clubs and music halls to get laid, and if they do, having a condom in your pocket is quite useful and quite socially responsible. Anyway, so I chucked this in because it was all about the commercialization of people's sex lives. I tossed in the American slang, because British people didn't use the word rubbers. They used the word johnnies at that time. So rubbers was not a British slang word. It's a bit like in the olden days when Buffy the Vampire Slayer was on. They would always use British slang like bollocks, because they thought Americans didn't know what it meant. Yeah, uh-huh. I remember when I first came to America thinking, what are you saying? So that lyric, we were in the charts. We had to be given a slot. The BBC said, "You've got the slot, but there's a rule," which was the Musicians Union said, "You have to re-record the song that you're on the charts to comply with the Musicians Union." So you have to go into the studio and re-record the track that's in the charts. But they said, "You've got to re-record it, but we don't like the word rubbers. You've got to sing it differently." So we had a bit of a discussion about this, and I think we all agreed that the opportunity's too big. Okay, let's change the word. So we re-recorded the track. In fact, we didn't re-record the track. We just re-recorded the word packets. So I dropped in the word packets over the original thing and then handed it over. Went into the studio and the producers were going nuts. The producer said, "We asked you to change the word." And I said, "Yeah, I have changed the word. It's now the packets you hide in your top left pocket." And they said, "We can't say that because it still means the same." And I said, "Yeah, it does mean the same." And said, "But the other thing is, you can hear that you've changed the word. We would like you to have used the word rubbish." So we had a very heated argument in which language was used that you wouldn't use before the watershed. So we really, and we had a big, we told them, we told them, you know, really pretty much where to go. And we were thrown off the show and the record was banned. And wow. That was that first of our records to be banned, to be followed years later by I Love a Man in a Uniform, which was banned, of course, in the UK.
Why was that song banned?
That's much later. That was on Songs of the Free. And that was banned because having written this song called I Love a Man in a Uniform, which is, you know, much more of a pop song than before, but it was about, you know, a guy whose life choices were so limited from a working class background, he had no choice but to get into uniform. So, and the chorus was I Love a Man in a Uniform. And it was quite sexy and it was quite cool and all that stuff. But and it was being played a lot on the radio in the UK until an event happened that was so, you know, left field, which was the Argentinian government invaded the Falkland Islands, Las Malvinas, and a place that I'd never even heard of. And because it mentioned a uniform, the sensitivity and the censorship was so strong. We went to do a TV show, and we turned up, and the producer to promote this thing, which was charting. And the producer said, "You were going to play Uniform. Well, you can play anything you like from your oeuvre, but you can't play that." I said, "Well, we're here to promote that because in the chart." I said, "Well, we can't because we've heard that our boys are going into to invade the island to retake the Falklands." And it was taken off the radio. It was banned because it mentioned a uniform.
We are talking because there is a new Gang of Four box set that collects some of your earliest recordings. Are you someone who revisits that old music regularly or, you know, was doing it for this box set something that, you know, you wouldn't normally do?
Yeah, I think like lots of musicians, I don't really like listening to my old things at all. It was good to listen to it, but I don't like to listen to it very much now. But it reminds me of all of the things, and I was impressed by the rigor of it all, and it reminded me so much of what we were doing. And the main sensation I had emotionally was how close we all were as a unit. You know, we were all incredibly good friends. We made each other do the best work that we could. And we also made each other laugh. I think one of the key things about the photographs and there's how many of them show the four of us clearly entertaining each other and enjoying it. But the music of that period that I still like to listen to, I love listening to The Slits, for example. Like Typical Girls. I prefer to listen to what they were doing to what we were doing because I don't want to, you know, listening to your own work is a bit strange, I think.
It's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, how close you were and what a unit you were. And that makes me want to hear your thoughts about Andy. Obviously, Andy passed away this year, and I just want to hear a little bit about him from you. What will you always remember about him?
Our lives were very social and working lives were very interwoven. I mean, I'd been friends of his since I was like 15. Actually, my wife had known him since she was 11. He used to go around to her house at the age of 11 and play chess with her older brother. So we were at the same high school together. I mean, we went to a school between the age of 11 and 18 called Seven Oaks School, and we all were, the group that we were in were all keen on art. And there was me and Andy and there were three other people, Kevin Lysette, Mark White, and Tom Greenhalgh, who formed the Mekons, all in the same class, and Paul Greengrass, the movie director, Adam Curtis, the documentary filmmaker, were all in the same class. And so I went off to Leeds with Kevin because I was in a year above Andy, and then Andy went up. And then he and I had flats next door to each other in this horrible house, you know, rented house, like classic student squalor. And he had an acoustic guitar, and I had a cassette recorder. And we used to sit there drinking cheap wine and writing genre songs, really, for a while. And then together, when I got a research grant to go to New York, Andy came along, and we then stayed together we crashed with Mary Harron, who was then a journalist on the New York Punk magazine. But later on, she directed American Psycho and the notorious wow. Betty Page. But Mary had just broken up, I think, with the drummer of the Patti Smith group, who were then unknown. And she had a flat in St. Mark's Place in New York. And so we used to go to CBGB's every night. We got in for nothing. So we hung out. So Andy and I hung out with Richard Hale and the Voidoids and the Dead Boys and all that lot, Talking Heads and Blondie and everyone, you know, who are all in this crappy bar. And so when we came back, it was sort of, our lives had become sort of baked. They become baked together. So we were very kind of entertainingly chalk and cheese, you know. You know, I'm a terrible, terrible guitarist, but I, you know, love playing words, you know. So it was, we traded off each other, you know, and we could do what the other one couldn't do. And it was very good. And I think we made each other laugh. I mean, you know, we laughed a lot, and we knew all of the words to all of the band songs. So very often we'd be singing, you know, Up on Cripple Creek together as a sort of, as a duet and things like that. Yeah.
Gang of Four music has been sampled by some pretty serious hip hop artists. I'm thinking of Run the Jewels and Frank Ocean specifically. What is it like to hear your music used like that?
I was so flattered, really, for both of them to use it. I mean, I think that Run the Jewels is a brilliant band, and I liked them before they did that. I mean, I actually thought it was a joke when someone said, "Dude," but they asked for permission. I think David ran into one of them in the studio on the West Coast, and they said, "Would you mind if we sample your song, Ether?" And of course. No, of course you didn't mind. And I think when Frank Ocean did that, I felt very musically pleased, because of course you're always standing on the shoulders of giants, you know. So just as we would sort of like heist something or other from Funkadelic, I'm not sure what it was, but you'd be inspired by something that you hear. And then to think that a band that's also like Run the Jewels trying to take on the complicatedness of urban life, and you know, hip hop has got a fantastic thread to it of talking about real life in those ways. And I was so thrilled that it's all like Ether, which is all about that. Trapped in Heaven lifestyle, locked in Longkesh, you know. So it's, you know, I think I mentioned earlier on the two opposing ideas. There was the interpret policy of innocent people, and then there's your own sort of feeling that you are your own jailer in your own home, you know, and which is quite a sort of proto hip hoppy kind of idea, isn't it? I suppose. I don't know.
John King, thanks so much for talking to us on Bullseye.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
John King, lead singer of Gang of Four. Gang of Four, 77 through 81, is a box set with live recordings and reissues of their brilliant records, Entertainment and Solid Gold. You can order the box set from your local record store. Thanks to my friend Jordan Morris for conducting this interview. Jordan also co-hosts the comedy show Jordan, Jesse, Go with me. I'm the Jordan from the title. He's the Go. Jordan also created Max Fun's scripted sci-fi podcast, Bubble, which you can download now and is now a graphic novel. You can pre-order it at your local bookstore. That's it for another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye created out of the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles. Here in my house, I've accepted that I'm an extra large now and am going through my clothes, getting rid of the larges. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio and Jordan Cowling are our associate producers. We get help from Casey O'Brien as well. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Richard Roby and Valerie Moffitt. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks very much to them and to their label, Memphis Industries, for sharing it. The Go Team have a record just around the corner. There's a single up right now. You should search for The Go Team on YouTube or whatever and give it a listen. You can also keep up with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We post all our interviews in those places. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.